And I'd like to introduce Brother Mark Vincent for the first class this afternoon, entitled Framing the Problem. Brother Mark.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. There's nothing like starting a book at the end, is there? And that's what we're going to spend most of our time in this first session, actually looking at Ecclesiastes 12. But before we get into that, let's spend a few minutes thinking about what the problem is. You can't have a talk called Framing the Problem unless you first of all identify what the problem is that you're framing. So what is the problem with the book of Ecclesiastes? Is there a problem at all? What's difficult about Ecclesiastes? Well, you might like to just think about that for a second. And I'd like to just take us on a little chain of verses, four or five or so verses, that we're not going to spend any great length of time with them, but they're useful in helping us identify that at least at some level the book of Ecclesiastes presents us with some challenge when we come to interpret it. Let's start in 2 verse 17. Therefore I hated life. So that's the attitude we're supposed to have to life, is it? The life that God has given us as his gift. Is it right to say that? Is it right to hate life? Does he really mean that he hates life? What does he mean? Let's carry on in the same verse. Therefore I hated life, because the work that is wrought under the sun is grievous unto me, for all is vanity and vexation of spirit. And notice the inclusiveness of that. All is vanity and vexation of spirit. Is that true? Is all vanity? And how do we reconcile that against when Paul says in Corinthians, your labour is not in vain in the Lord? So is all of life vanity, or isn't it? What's the context in which we should interpret Ecclesiastes? Because it's clear, just from setting those two verses very crudely next to each other, all is vanity and your labour is not in vain in the Lord, it's very clear that there is some reconciliation that we need to do here. We need to set a context for what Ecclesiastes is talking about. The all that he talks about clearly isn't quite all, is it? It's all within a certain context. Let's turn over to chapter 3 and verse 19. For that which befalleth the sons of man befalleth beasts, even one thing befalleth them, as the one dieth, so dieth the other. Yea, they have all one breath, so that a man hath no preeminence above a beast, for all is vanity. What about that? Man hath no preeminence above a beast. Is that a picture that we would get from other scriptures? And when we think about how Genesis 1 builds to the climax of God's creation as being the creation of man on the sixth day, again, clearly we need a context in which to understand what the Ecclesiastes verse means. And there he goes again, for all is vanity, at the end of verse 19. Have a look at verse 22. Wherefore I perceive that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his portion, for who shall bring him to see that which shall be after him? And again, you see the difficulties there. It's good for a man that he should rejoice in his own works. Now that can't be being used in the way in which your own works is used elsewhere in the scriptures, can it? Because we're supposed to cease from our own works and be involved in the works of God. So what does the preacher mean when he says this? And when he says, who shall bring him to see what shall be after him? Well, that's exactly what God does do in the Bible, to show us what shall be after us. So you see the problem. And I know it's a little bit artificial, and I know I'm creating it in very stark terms, and I know that we can reconcile these verses, and we can come to understand how it all fits together. But before we get to that, it's worth just staring the problem in quotes in the face for a few moments. Chapter 4 and verse 2. Wherefore I praise the dead which are already dead more than the living which are yet alive. So it's better to be dead when life is a gift of God. Yea, better is he than both they which hath not yet been and hath not seen the evil work that is done under the sun. So that is nullifying God's gift of life, isn't it? Saying it's better not to have had that gift. It's not a gift at all. Some gift. No. If what he's saying in that verse is absolutely true, so we need to have a way in which we're going to try to understand verses like this to make our understanding of the scriptures as a whole consistent. Chapter 6 and verse 12. Just another couple of these now. Chapter 6 and verse 12, because I think my point hopefully is becoming clear enough. For who knoweth what is good for man in this life, all the days of his vain life which he spendeth as a shadow? For who can tell a man what shall be after him under the sun? Again, the preacher asserts our inability to know. Who knows what is good for us in this life? Well, the Bible tells us what is good. And what does Malachi say? Or is it Micah? He has showed thee, O man, what is good. And here the preacher is saying, who knows what's good? Who shall tell a man what shall be after him under the sun? And that's parallel to a verse that we already looked at, isn't it? Well, God does tell us what his plan is and what is going to come after us. And finally, chapter 7 and verse 16. Be not righteous over much, neither make thyself over wise. Why shouldest thou destroy thyself? Be not over much wicked, neither be thou foolish. Why shouldest thou die before thy time? Well, you can see there's a sort of pragmatism to his approach, but is it the right approach? Be not righteous over much. So we should set limits to our righteousness, should we? And we should say, well, I'm going to be satisfied with just that much righteousness. That's righteous enough for me. And how does that sit against be therefore perfect as your Father which is in heaven is perfect? So there is, in the words of Ecclesiastes, as far as I can tell, no hint of resurrection as an explicit doctrine. There is no explicit identification of what our hope might be. There is a verse which says, for he who is alive has hope, and a living dog is better than a dead lion. But, you know, that's hardly an explicit verse in terms of our understanding of our hope for the future, is it? So, we can see then, just from that simple observation, that the scope of what the preacher is talking about doesn't extend to God's ultimate purpose in the resurrection and the kingdom. He's not dealing with those matters. He's dealing with other matters. So we're going to have to set bounds for ourselves in terms of what it is that he's talking about. There is certainly teaching about judgment. One can certainly get from the book of Ecclesiastes the doctrine that God will judge people. But that's not developed into what the outcome of that judgment might be, or what God's ultimate plan is. So there's a limit then to the context about what Ecclesiastes is talking about. And as if that wasn't enough, then we've also got the issue of contradictions in the book, where at one point the preacher seems to say one thing, and then in the next chapter you might find him saying something which you can set up as a complete contradiction between the two chapters. And so we have to work out, well, is there a way in which they can be resolved? What does he mean? Does he mean to be contradicting himself? And that's a big issue for the interpretation of the book. So we've got quite a challenge really today and tomorrow, because 6 sessions, God willing, looking at the book of Ecclesiastes. And of course it's quite a pessimistic book, isn't it? And we don't want to get too depressed. You can imagine after the end of 6 talks we might not only agree with this point that much study is a weariness of the flesh, but also we might feel rather downcast by it all. But that's a point that the preacher wants to take us to in order, I think, to redeem us from it. And that's rather like what happens in Romans, a very different context, but you know how Romans begins with that very depressing chapter about the wickedness of the Gentiles, and look at the Gentiles and say, what a hopeless lot, turning the glory of the incorruptible God into an image of corruptible things, and how God had to give them up. And then we turn to the wickedness of the Jews, and they're just as bad in a different way. And then we turn to my wickedness and your wickedness, and that same wickedness is in us too. And so Paul brings us to this point where every mouth is stopped and the whole world is silent and guilty before God. And it's only if you get to that point that God can then start to speak in order to redeem us and to raise us up from that place of despair that our sins have brought us to. And in a way, the book of Ecclesiastes is like the first step of that process. It brings us to that point of despair, of seeing the futility and emptiness of life. But of course, the book of Ecclesiastes isn't the entire Bible. And so much of the rest of the Bible then redeems us from that position to which we've got at the end of the book of Ecclesiastes. So we've got to remember that when we get ourselves a little bit depressed, when we look at these words of Ecclesiastes, what we're trying to do is we're trying to understand what it's like to be human. We're trying to understand the human condition and what it really means. You know, stop ourselves in our busy lives and say, hang on a minute, what is it really like? What's it all about? What is the point? And there's no other book of the scriptures that address that question so powerfully in terms of you know, what has the world to offer? What is the point of life? And we get to the point where we realize that there isn't one unless God is at the center of our lives. And that is left largely for the other scriptures to redeem us and to show us what the point is. And yet, there are important and essential clues about the answer to the problem within the book itself. And we'll come on to those in a moment. Before we get to chapter 12, though, let's go to chapter 1. So, for the rest of this session, we're going to have a look at the very beginning of the book, and then go to the end. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. So the author doesn't identify himself by his name, which of course immediately gives rise to the question, well, who is it then? Who is the author? And of course the usual answer to that is Solomon, and that's an answer I'm completely happy with. Nevertheless, it's worth noticing that it doesn't actually say, isn't it? It's worth noticing that. So there is some room for someone to take a different view if they so chose to do so, and yet, although it's true that there were other sons of David, and the son of David is used in a more or less literal sense, Solomon, of course, was the son of David, and he was king in Jerusalem. And he was, of course, the only son of David who was king over all Israel in Jerusalem, because after him the kingdom was divided. And if we look into chapter 1 and chapter 2 and the kind of adventures that the preacher has, the kind of experiments he engages in, then of course it speaks to us of Solomon as he collects wisdom and information and possessions. That sounds very like what we know from the books of Kings and Chronicles about the reign of Solomon. So that fits with Solomon. There's a reference in chapter 7 as well, which fits well with Solomon. Now, of course, most scholars don't think it was Solomon, and they have reasons for thinking that, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but just maybe a minute. People debate about the language of the book, and they say, well, there's a few Aramaic words, and therefore does that mean the book was written later than Solomon's time? And then someone else, some other scholar has come along and said, no, actually Aramaic was used in very early times, so that's no argument. And then someone else comes along and says, but here are some Persian words, doesn't that mean it's later? And then someone else says, well, perhaps those Persian words got imported into the language earlier. So there's a whole load of books that you can read about the dating of Ecclesiastes, but effectively they get you nowhere. And that's an example of the making of many books. There is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. It's kind of an unfruitful avenue to explore. So there are no concrete arguments that are definitive about when the book should be dated, and I think it's entirely legitimate to think that it was that Solomon is himself the preacher. You could take a different view. You could say that the preacher is some unidentified author who adopts the persona of Solomon, that it's sort of a literary device in which the writer pretends to be Solomon, as it were, and passes on his own advice, as it were, through the mouthpiece of Solomon. I think, it's possible for someone to take that position and still to believe in the full inspiration of Scripture. I don't see any great advantage in taking that position, and I think that most people would take the position that it is indeed Solomon, and I think that's a perfectly sensible thing to do. So enough on that, but it is interesting that he doesn't actually identify himself. And does that in a way put a little bit of distance between what Solomon, if indeed it is Solomon, really thought, and what this character of the preacher might have to say? Possible. Let's read verse 2. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. So you see now, there is a third person comes in, isn't there, in verse 2, because there's someone has inserted there, saith the preacher. These are the words of the preacher. And I don't suddenly, in the middle of my sentence, I'm talking to you as I, this is what I think, I don't then suddenly say, saves the Englishman. I don't suddenly say that in the middle of my words. That would just be bizarre. And similarly, Seth the preacher here, it's the editor of the book who's saying these words now, vanity of vanities, all is vanity, vexation of spirit, these words are the words of the preacher. So the words of the preacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem, is the editor, and then the preacher starts to speak. Preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity of vanities, all is vanities. Editor, Seth the preacher. And then the preacher comes along again and tells us what he has to say. And most of the rest of the book is the words of the preacher. But you see, and now this is the idea of the frame, framing the problem. The editor introduces the preacher to us then, doesn't he? The editor says, here you are, I'm about to show you the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. And this is what he says. And then comes all the words of the preacher. And then at the end of the book, as we read in chapter 12, and we'll turn it up in a moment, these are the things that the preacher said. And because the preacher was wise, he collected all these things together and he set in order many proverbs. And hear what the conclusion of the whole matter is. And those words are all the words of the editor again. So you see, there's a frame around the book. There's the words of the preacher in the middle, basically 1 verse 2 through to 12 verse 6 or so. And then at each side, a very short bit at the beginning, verse 1, and a longer bit of 6 verses at the end, we've got the words of the editor, this third person. And that beginning and the end then creates a frame around the words of the preacher in the majority of the book. And my suggestion is that is helpful in setting a context for what most of the book of Ecclesiastes, for what the words of the preacher mean. And I'll enlarge on that in a few moments. Let's just talk a little bit, I'll just lose my jacket, let's just talk for a little minute about that term, the preacher. Well, it's the Hebrew term is Kohelet, And, you know, that's what the book is called. And lots of people who write about Ecclesiastes just use that term, Kohelet, instead of using the preacher. They just use the Hebrew term. So if you ever read about Kohelet, that's who it is. It's the preacher. It's the Hebrew word for the preacher there in 1 verse 1. And that comes from a root which means to collect, to gather. So it could mean two things. It could mean either someone who collects or gathers facts, observations, and that these are his collected observations. That's possible. And there is a sense in which some parts of Ecclesiastes are a little bit like an information dump, where, you know, these are, and here's some more observations, and here's some more observations that I had, and I saw this, and then I turned and I saw this, and then I turned and I saw something else, and these things are sort of collected together like that. And although in some parts of the book you can see a very clear order, how he moves, you know, systematically from one point to the next and builds up towards a conclusion of sorts, and then he goes off into something else, there are other parts of the book that seem much more miscellaneous, and indeed more like a collection in that sense. However, usually that word, to collect, to gather, is used of people. So someone who collects or gathers people together, who assembles people together, in order to teach them. Yeah. Like a sort of MC, or an assembler or gatherer of people. And, there's a way in which the word ecclesia, in terms of someone calling out to people, is and assembling people in that way is similar. And you can notice, of course, that what does the Septuagint, the Greek translation of Ecclesiastes, what does it use as its title? It's used the word Ecclesiastes, and you can see the obvious similarity between the word ecclesia and the word Ecclesiastes, and that's come because of that word preacher, Kohelet. So that's, I think that's all we need to say about 1 verse 1. Let's have a bit more of a look at 1 verse 2. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. References to that term. So there's no doubt, is there, when we're beginning here, there's no doubt what the key word of this book is. It's the word vanity. So what can we say about that word? Well, it occurs about 37 times in the book, which is a measure of how dominant it is. What does it mean? Well, it means a vapor, something which is light, something which is intransient, something which you can't get hold of, something which has no substance. You remember Abel? It's a closely related form. It's from the same word. As in Cain and Abel, and how his life was in a sense a vanity. It was his death was pointless, wasn't it? It was a folly. And it's interesting that it's that word that should become this key word here. You know, what's the point of that? And of course, that was something that was brought about by human behaviour. And lots of things in Ecclesiastes are brought about by human behaviour. And Abel's life just vanished like that, and that was the end of him because of Cain's stupidity and cruelty. And there are things about life in the book of Ecclesiastes that are going to be just like that. But it doesn't just mean that. That's the sort of basic idea of the word breath, vapor. But it goes on to mean things like, by extension, to mean things like meaningless, pointless, absurd is how one translator likes to translate it. Absurd in the sense of things that don't fit together. You know, you have something, you expect that it would fit together like that smoothly, and it would be, but it's not. Things, it's like there's a dislocation. Things don't fit together in the way that you might expect them to, or the way in which you might want them to. Futile, pointless, absurd. And we're going to see all kinds of things about human life that the preacher characterizes by that term. And then, of course, that other term there, vexation of spirit, isn't used in that verse, but that's another term which, as you know, occurs something as some kind of a refrain through the book. Searching, pursuing after wind. That's the idea there. Vexation of spirit. So let's have a look at chapter 7 for a moment, on our way through to chapter 12 and verse 27. And we're just going to pull a verse out of context here, but for a particular reason. That is the wrong verse. There is one other verse where this little phrase, vanity of vanities, occurs. And I thought I had it written down, but it's not the verse that I had written down. Let's go on to chapter 12. Sorry about that. I'll try and find that verse later on. Chapter 12 and verse 8. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, all is vanity. Do you recognise that? Well, of course you do. It's exactly what it said in 1 verse 2, isn't it? And those are the only two places in the book, and my reason for saying 7:27 was different. Those are the only two places in the book where that full phrase, of course the term vanity occurs lots of times, this also is vanity, this also is vanity. More or less everything you look at is vanity as far as the preacher is concerned. But this longer version, vanity of vanities, all is vanity, that only occurs at 1 verse 2 and 12 verse 8. And you notice now that the editor has come to the surface again, hasn't he, in 12 verse 8. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher. And this is like me as Seth the Englishman again. You know, I'm not going to do that. That's going to be someone else who said, you know, forget all that Englishman was talking about. That would be someone else saying that. And here, now, the editor steps in and points out that up to this point, and including this conclusion, vanity of vanities, all is vanity, those are all the words of the preacher. And so all the words of the preacher are framed by this phrase, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. There it is in 1 verse 2, and there it is at the end of chapter 12. That's the frame around the book. And so everything that comes in between in the book, the preacher's observations, can be encapsulated by that phrase, can be summed up in that phrase, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. That's his assessment of things. And either side of that, the editor has something to say. So at the beginning, the editor says, these are the words of the preacher, King, son of David, King of Jerusalem. And at the end of the book, the editor steps up again to the plate and says, and now I've got some more points to make. So we're going to look at those points in a second. There was one, the 7 verse 27 was actually the right verse. I just forgot why we were going there. So again, apologies. Just look back at 7:27 for a second, because this is the one other place that the editor rears his head, as it were, above the parapet, and you can see him. 7:27, behold, this have I found, saith the preacher, counting one by one to find out the account. And that's pretty much close to the middle of the book, in fact, where the editor just pops up from behind the desk and says, here I am, remember, these are the words of the preacher that we're dealing with here. And you're going to need a context for understanding those verses, otherwise you're going to have that problem that we began with. that problem which we've now framed by this expression, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Now, I keep promising to get to chapter 12. There's one more thing, actually, I want to say before we do, and that's about some numerical patterns. Now, I don't know what you think about numerical patterns. I think some of them are interesting, and some of them are arbitrary and forced. That's my personal opinion. And, of course, you have to make a judgment on any given example where there are numerical patterns of which kind it is. I mean, there are some people at one end of this extreme who say, no, all that number stuff is just... it's just people's imagination, and there are other people who, you know, looking for numerical patterns in virtually every verse or name that you find in the pages of the Bible. And I like to think I'm perfectly balanced in the middle, which, of course, we probably all like to think, and none of us probably are. Well, let me tell you what some of the numerical patterns are in Ecclesiastes, and I'm not really going to make a judgment on them. I think they're interesting, and I think there probably is something behind this. So we've talked about that frame, vanity of vanities, all is vanity, at 1 verse 2 and 12 verse 8. Add the numerical value of that up and you come to 216, which is the precise number of verses from the beginning of the book to the frame in 12 verse 8. The numerical value of the first word of Ecclesiastes, which translates the words of, is also 216. The numerical value of vanity is 37. How many times does it occur in the book? 37 times. And there are two textually doubtful places where it also occurs in 5 verse 7 and 9 verse 9. So most scholars exclude those, and then you get to 37. Now, of course, you can say, aha, you only got to 37 because you excluded those two verses. Well, you then have to have a debate about those verses, wouldn't you? Which I'm not going to get into now. So, you know, there is an element of, well, you have to make a judgment on what the validity of these points are. I think the points that I'm making have a reasonable validity to them. There are a whole load of other points that you can also make which I think have less validity, which is why I'm not going to give you those ones. Let's go on a little bit. So vanity, so that occurs three times in the frame, doesn't it? Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Add the numerical value of that together and you get to 111, and that is the precise number of verses to the midpoint of the book. What is the midpoint of the book? Well, it's 6 verse 9. Let's have a look at 6 verse 9 and see what that says. It says this: better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the desire. This also is vanity and vexation of spirit. Not quite the frame, but pretty close, isn't it? This also is vanity and vexation of spirit. And in fact, if you take that as being the midpoint, this also is vanity and vexation of spirit, you have in fact precisely the same number of words from the beginning of the book to that point as from that point to the end of the book, which is, I think that's pretty incredible, and would to me be a sign of the hand of God being at work here. Are there any more of these? Well, I think that's probably enough. So there was a chap, Wright, I think his name was, A.G. Wright with a W, who wrote a book about this. He called it The Riddle of the Sphinx. And he came up with a very elaborate structure to the book of Ecclesiastes, and he pointed out some of these numerical points and a whole load of others as well. I think that the elaborate structure that he came up with was a bit contrived, but I think that the numerical points that I have made are interesting, but I'm not going to say any more about that. You know, it's a sort of a be that as it may, but it seems pretty interesting to me. Let's finally then get to chapter 12, and the rest of our time will be spent here. Chapter 12 and verse 9. Now, this is all now the words of the editor. So the editor now isn't the preacher, it's someone else. And he is drawing out for us a conclusion from the words of the preacher. And that is critically important. See, we've seen some of the problems you can get into if you take the preacher too literally. And that's what we did with that opening chain of verses that we looked at. And we said, well, how can you say that all is vain in relation to what Corinthians says about your labour is not in vain? So we can see that we've seen that we needed the context for those verses. Now, the editor provides us that context because he tells us, in effect, now, those were the words of the preacher, and this is the conclusion. This is what you should draw from what the preacher said. And so he, as it were, shows us a way of reading what the preacher has said. And that's fascinating then. It gives us the interpretational clue as to what the preacher was talking about. And then if we then go back into the words of the preacher, as we'll be doing for the rest of these talks, we can find that indeed that is the case, that we can find things in the words of the preacher that chime with the conclusion that the editor has drawn. And we'll have also found a context by which to understand the words of the preacher that don't seem to chime with it. That's the theory anyway. Let's have a look at what the editor says. And moreover, and the word, that little phrase, and moreover, that you could also translate that, incidentally, coming back to numerics for one second, you could also translate that as six additional, because the word for moreover has the numerical value of six. The word and has a numerical value of six. So six additional, and of course there are exactly six additional verses that the editor adds. So I think that's just a little play on words that's going on there. And moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. So there were some important things going on there then. So the preacher was wise. So there are verses within what the preacher had to say that seemed to be very sceptical of wisdom. They seem to say, well, wisdom might seem to be quite good, but actually when you really get down to it, there's not much point to wisdom either. And here, effectively, the editor is saying to us, no, don't interpret it in that way. The preacher was wise. And his wisdom has a value. And he still taught the people knowledge. So despite all the scepticism that is expressed in the book of Ecclesiastes, despite all the pessimism, the preacher still, despite that burden of human life that he felt, he still taught the people knowledge. So he still believed in the value of knowledge. So if, as some scholars have, you come to an interpretation of the words of the preacher that says, nope, he's a complete skeptic, he just disputes the value of anything, there's no point to anything in life, then you've misread what he's saying. And that's what a lot of scholars have done. That's a misreading of the preacher. That's what the editor's telling us here. He's saying, nope, the preacher was wise, and despite that scepticism that he had, he still taught the people knowledge. Why would you do that if you thought that knowledge didn't have any value? He still taught the people knowledge. Yea, he gave good heed. He didn't just throw down his tools and say, well, it's just all so much vanity and vexation of spirit, I can't even be bothered anymore, I'm just going to go and sit down. No, he still taught the people knowledge, and he gave good heed. He paid attention. Because he'd seen that vanity in life, therefore he dedicated himself to seek out and to set in order many proverbs. You see how tremendously important that is, after all the scepticism that there has been. Because, as I say, some people read the words of the preacher and they find nothing but scepticism. And that is a misreading. Yes, there is scepticism. There's lots of scepticism in there. But there's also faith in there too. And the editor here is telling us, don't ignore the faith. The preacher was wise, and he taught the people knowledge, and he set in order many proverbs to help them be wise too, because he believed that ultimately there was a value in wisdom. The preacher sought to find out acceptable words, and that which was written was upright, even words of truth. So what the preacher has had to say here and in the proverbs is true. words of truth. True in a sense, maybe, but in that sense, true. And the mechanism that he used, by and large, to do that was the mechanism of Proverbs. And that's another suggestion then, isn't it, that the preacher is in fact Solomon, because we've got a whole book of Proverbs sat next to the book of Ecclesiastes. So after all the doubts that he went through in the book of Ecclesiastes, he still sought out and collected these Proverbs together, these wise words, so that people could benefit from them, because he thought that there was value in them doing so. The words of the wise are as goads. And you should probably understand the rest of the verse like this. And the words of masters of collections, so the assemblies isn't assemblies of people, it's collections of proverbs or of wise writings, like Ecclesiastes and Song of Solomon's and Proverbs. The words of the wise are as goads, and the words of the masters of collections are like nails fastened by one shepherd, or by a shepherd. I think probably you should take one there in the sense of rather than, you know, what's the one about. I think it's probably just to be interpreted in the sense of a shepherd. And there are other verses that you can pull out to justify that. So what's that saying then? It's saying that the purpose of Proverbs and the purpose of wise writings in the scriptures is that they should be like goads, or like nails used for prodding the cattle. Why do you use a goad with an ox? Well, you use it to make the ox go where you want it to go, to make it do things. And that's what the Proverbs and the words of the wise, like the words of the wise Solomon, are for. They're to make us do things. And the book of Ecclesiastes, then, is like that too. It's not there to make us say, well, what's the point? There isn't any point. It's not that kind of scepticism that the book should lead us to. It should be like a goad to us, prodding us, pressing us to make something better of our lives, let's say. And that point is now further hammered home after a point of contrast has been made. So when we study these things, then we should remember what they're designed for. They're not designed for so much academic study. They're designed so that we should go out of here and be different people than what we were before we read them. That we should be spurred to good works and to labour, which is not in vain in the Lord. And further, by contrast, verse 12, by these, my son, be admonished, of making of many books there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. So there's a whole lot of books out there, there certainly is. And there's a lot of theories, there are a lot of opinions, there's a lot of debate, and you can give all your life to that if you want, but if you do that, you'll have wasted your time, because you've got to remember that life is to be lived, and that there is to be a practical outworking of study. And the Lord Jesus didn't spend his ministry sat in a room studying books. He went out and lived what he already knew as the Word of God. So of course we've got to get the Word of God in there, and we've got to have those times for meditation and study, absolutely. No one's suggesting otherwise, not for 1 minute. But it's not the end in itself, as we well know. Think of the cattle prod. Let us hear then the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. So that's the conclusion. What conclusion should you draw? So, people who've not paid attention to these words as a help in interpreting Ecclesiastes have gone in all kinds of directions. And just to give you one, there's a line of Jewish interpretation which says, well, there are these wise Jewish writings, and what the book of Ecclesiastes is doing is basically undermining them and saying, look, that's all just so much trite wisdom. And this is saying, no, the purpose of the book isn't for that. What is the conclusion of the what is the conclusion that we should draw from the book? It spells it out to us precisely because there is doubt. If all you had was the words of the preacher, you might be able to go in several different directions. But this conclusion tells you what direction you should go in. The conclusion is this. This is the thing that is worthwhile. This is the thing that is not a vanity. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. And that is so powerful, isn't it? Fear God and keep his commandments. That sums up everything that we're trying to do in our lives. For this is the whole duty of man. And you notice there that duty is in italics, so that word's not there. This is the whole man, is one way some people understand it. Some people understand it as this is every man. This is what every man should be. And you know, we have that expression, I'm all ears, don't we? And what does that mean? I mean, literally, it's a nonsense. I'm all ears. Well, of course I'm not. But what it means is, at the moment you say I'm all ears, you're saying there's nothing else for me at this moment other than listening to you. I'm entirely here for you and to hear those words that you're about to say to me. That's what I am all ears means. And in a similar way, this is saying, what is man? What should man be about? Man should be about one thing: fearing God and keeping his commandments. That's what man should be. That's what should constitute a man. A man of God. And that's a high ideal, isn't it, for us to strive for. That's enough. Thank you.